You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
Children International is working to end child poverty around the world by giving kids access to a safe place, a team, and a path out of poverty by focusing on health, education, empowerment, and employment. Together with people like you, we're more than a nonprofit. We're a powerful force for change. Learn more at children.org.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, November 2nd, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Nicholas Guyette, University lecturer in American history at Cambridge University, on his book, Bind Us Apart, How Enlightened Americans Invented Racial Segregation. Also on the program today, something for everyone in the polls, and why a transit strike may derail Pennsylvania's vote for Clinton. Meanwhile, Trump's tax scheme, another one found to be illegal, and a video shows him with a Russian mobster that he says he never met. Also, latest WikiLeaks docs show just how greasy those in the Clinton orbit can be.
But not much more.
Has there been a 28% GOP vote for Clinton in Florida in early voting? According to a new poll, 28% have crossed over. And the Freedom Caucus already meeting in D.C. to strategize their attacks on Paul Ryan and Hillary Clinton. It's probably a twofer.
That's so great.
They got such an agenda.
They're actually going to help.
Oh, yeah. A woman is accusing Clarence Thomas of groping her in 1999. You'll recall that was seven years after his hearings. And in West Virginia, you remember Freedom Industries that poured all that chemical into, well, companies that are still around are paying off that settlement. And Trump's USA-er, why the deuce, from this weird right-wing show, Ken, Ken, and Ken.
It's a really out there one. Not on the grid, really.
Probably the only reliable conservative source out there. Right. Guy nailed it. And Hannity does live radio, and apparently they have no internet because of it. I'm not sure how that works, but all that and more on today's Majority Report. I can't tell what's going on, guys, but what's the problem? You can't get that TV to work? All right. That's something we got to deal with before the show, not during the show. Here is a remote. I don't know if this is the remote you need. So a lot of stuff. I mean, you know, it's a very weird time right now because everybody's got a different poll that they are citing. This poll coming out of Florida apparently is has been done with people who have already voted. And so this is not it's an exit poll of sorts, I guess, but it's people who have voted early. So it's a different type of people. Now, I don't know. They claim they can extrapolate. They think Clinton will win by something like 6 points in Florida. I don't know about that. There's a lot of different competing polls and methodology out there. I am still rather confident that Hillary Clinton will exceed Barack Obama's 2012 margin.
We're going to have to put our predictions out soon.
Yes. And we'll come closer to the 2008 margin. May actually exceed the 2008 margin, but I think we'll definitely exceed the 2012. The Senate, going to be tighter. Although, if we get into 2008 territory, I think 51, 52 seats is not impossible. We'll talk more about that. We'll have another bite at that apple, probably on Friday. But people are freaking out. I'm getting calls from my daughter. She's 11. She's freaking out.
Not good.
Not good. But, you know, it's all about data.
Your data.
Or data. Periscope data is the ultimate tool for fast and flexible data visualization. Why run slow queries on old spreadsheet data when Periscope data allows you to run, visualize, and share analysis over billions of data rows in seconds? Billions. Answer the big questions instead of running routine SQL tasks again and again. Periscope data is fast, powerful, and effortless to connect. Blazing fast query execution, fast workflow, fast sharing, so you can internally collaborate. You can share it outside. You can embed the in your app. And it's an ease of trial. There's a no setup cost or time. You can get out of it with literally one click. So as far as trying this out, super easy to do. Charts and dashboards are always up to date. You never run the same query twice. You can slice the data in any way you want. Periscope data is a powerful and intuitive tool that will bring your SQL analysis to the next level. Get a free trial today by going to periscopedata.com/majority. That's www.periscopedata.com/majority. Like I say, the free trial, super easy to get in and out of. Check it out. We don't have a SQL database here, so. But if we did, Kelly, and I was telling her a long time ago, get the SQL database. Nope. Nobody in the office knew what it meant. That was the problem. All right, let's listen to, this is CNN's Randy Kay. Is in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And here she is, interviewing Trump supporters. And this is sort of fun right here, what they have to say. Let's listen. Do we have it? Here it is.
And that God chose for a time as this.
Are you concerned at all about your candidate's character?
Absolutely not. No. I think we've all fallen short of the, you know, of what God expects of all of us. So we've all missed the mark. So he missed the mark a few times.
This voter originally supported Ben Carson, but now is backing Trump.
He's not perfect. I'm not looking for perfect. I'm looking for somebody to save this country.
Many here admit that Trump has flaws, but given the options, they say they can look beyond them. They are even willing to forgive him for bragging about groping women on that Access Hollywood tape.
Does it bother you to hear him talk about women that way or no?
Yes, but is it a deal breaker? No.
Some of that, the media has made it be worse than what it is. It doesn't bother me.
The tape is the tape. I mean, he said those things on the tape.
Yeah, it doesn't bother me.
What about those women accusing him of sexually assaulting them? Not even that makes women voters here question Trump's character.
I think those women need to grow with that personally. You know, it's been a lot of years. Get over it.
So there you have it. Now, it's unclear, I want to say, to be fair, it is unclear at this juncture as to whether or not it's going to be mandatory under a Trump presidency for women to grow a set.
Oh, you bet. Someone needs to.
Or a pair. A pair or a set. Now, it's possible you might be able to get a waiver where you just grow one. But there you have
Believe
it.
Believe me.
I know. We shouldn't make fun of Trump voters. So mean.
It's about economic anxiety. Anyways, those freaking sexually assaulted broads need to grow a pair because I'm worried about NAFTA.
Oh. All right, check this out. The Casper.
There's texture in there too, right?
Yeah. I'll talk about texture because I use it on a daily basis. I try not to use it on the weekends as much just because I'll get in trouble with the family. But on a daily basis, the Texture app lets you tap into the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your smartphone or tablet. You can breeze through hundreds of your favorite magazines, including back issues, pick the articles that interest you most, almost create your own magazine. I mean, you know, to the extent that that makes any sense on your phone, but you become your own aggregator and you only have to pay one subscription. You don't have to pay subscriptions for all these magazines. I almost hesitate to talk about like the New Yorker because the New Yorker, I don't understand how this works, frankly, because the New Yorker subscription is almost more than the whole Texture subscription in the first place. I don't know if I'm supposed to mention that even. But the best part, Texture's offering my listeners a free trial right now when you go to texture.com/majority. It's an app. You download it onto your smartphone. You pick the magazines that you want. You can pick them. You can just browse through them or you can pick them all so that your favorite ones are right there. Or you can just pick articles from them. You can do whatever you want. It's very flexible. You gain immediate entry into all the top magazines, including the back issues and the bonus video content that they put out. Start binge reading for free right now when you go to texture.com/majority. That's texture.com/majority. I'm going to tell you the magazines that I read off of this. This is just some of them, but the regular ones. Variety, which I read just to pretend like I'm still in show business. Adweek. Just so that I could get a sense of maybe I could do some marketing someday. Architectural Digest, Bicycling, may want to get in shape again. Dwell, I guess I'm a little handyman. Family Handyman, yes.
Peter Thiel.
HGTV Magazine, I think Milo likes to watch sometimes. She likes to like flip my house stuff. New York Magazine, The New Yorker, The Smithsonian, Sports Illustrated, Wired, I read. And then there's some here even for someone like Michael. Like
Yoga Journal. Boom. And
Working Mother.
Working Mother, right.
Yes.
Good stuff.
And also, what else do we have here for you? Well, it's not fresh because I mentioned it earlier before the show, and then you just stepped
fresh, up. Fresh, yeah, I did. Well, that's okay.
What else? Southern Living. Michael likes that one.
That one, you know what? I'll give you that one. That's pretty funny.
And Shape Magazine. I don't know what that is. Shape? I don't know.
It doesn't have a description.
Folks, texture.com/majority. This one, I think we're going to buy another mattress. Because the first one we love. And we literally, Mila and Saul get in fights about it. It's Saul's mattress. But Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. For me, it's also the big thing for me are the price. Mattress, you know, can cost, I've heard, when people tell me they've got like a $2,000 mattress, I just look at them and I'm just like, you got to be kidding me.
Big league.
Honestly, apparently people pay that kind of money for a mattress or more. But let's just assume most mattresses cost, you know, more reasonably, somewhere around $1,500, I guess, for a king size. Casper costs $500 for a twin size mattress, $600 for a twin XL, $750 for a full, $850 for a queen, $950 for a king. And I'll tell you something, Saul has a twin. It is the most comfortable mattress in the house. And Mila and Saul fight about it. She's like, I'm going to sleep on his bed tonight. And no, you're not. Get out. They share a room. That's the problem. Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Combines springy latex and supportive memory foams to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Time magazine named it one of its best inventions of 2015. Free shipping and returns to U.S. Canada. This is the amazing thing about it. They ship it to you in a box. It's amazing. I don't know how they get it in there. They ship it to you in a box. You can try the mattress for 100 nights. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Made in America, folks. Get $50 off any mattress purchase. That's if you buy the twin. That's 10% off. By visiting Casper.com/majority using the offer code majority. It's Casper.com/majority. They ship it and return it from America and Canada. All right, folks, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, Nicholas Guyot, university lecturer in American history at Cambridge University, author of Bind Us Apart, How Enlightened Americans Invented Racial Segregation. Be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Nicholas Guyot. He is a university lecturer in American history at Cambridge University, author of Bind Us Apart, How Enlightened Americans Invented Racial Segregation. Welcome to the program, Nicholas.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me on.
All right. Let's start with with Edward Coles. He's quite an interesting figure in your book. And we should just tell people, this deals with the history of the first couple hundred years of this country or so in relationship to both African-Americans and Native Americans. But start with Edward Coles.
Yeah, the book is about how Americans dealt with the fact that white Americans dealt with the fact they lived alongside African Americans and Native Americans after the American Revolution. And, you know, to get to Coles, I guess you need to understand that he is someone who's in the same social circle as Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and the other founders. But he's a bit younger than they are. So he's a Virginian. His family owned slaves. And for folks like Jefferson and Madison, we tend to think that when it came to the phrase all men are created equal, that meant that all white men were created equal. And Jefferson and Madison looked at African-Americans or Native Americans and just thought they weren't human. And one of the big arguments I try and make in the book is that actually it wasn't that easy for slaveholders, or it wasn't that easy for people that wanted Indian land, because actually there was nothing really to say that African-Americans or Native Americans were permanently inferior to white people. You know, if you went off and looked at the science books or looked at religion, you couldn't really justify that opinion of their inferiority at all. So it kind of created a problem in the early Republic for people like Jefferson and for Madison. And what's really interesting about these guys is that problem was experienced particularly by the next generation. And that's where Edward Coles comes in. He's a really fascinating guy. He was born in 1786 in Virginia. He went to William & Mary College, which was the same college that Thomas Jefferson went to. And when he was at William & Mary in the early 19th century, so in the early 1800s, he found that all the faculty there, they couldn't justify slavery. So, I mean, they all said that slavery existed solely because, you know, the British had brought it into the United States. And Coles decided that he didn't want to inherit the slaves that he was going to inherit in his will from his father. So when his father died in 1808, he inherited about two dozen slaves, and he decided he was going to have to find a way to free them. But here's where it gets really interesting, Sam, because how do you free African-Americans in the early United States in a state like Virginia? Well, it turns out Virginia had just changed the law a couple of years before that to say if you freed your slaves as a slaveholder, you had to take them out of the state. So actually, Coles is really interesting because eventually he decides in 1819 that he's going to move west. He's going to head out to Illinois, takes his slaves with him, and then he frees them all. And he says they can stay with him if they want to go out to Illinois, which they all do. He becomes the governor of Illinois, and he keeps slavery out of the new state. So in some ways, he's a kind of precursor to Abraham Lincoln as this person that kept Illinois free. But there's a sting in the tail, which is that he comes to decide in the 1820s that in the long run, it's going to be impossible for black people to remain in the United States after slavery. So he becomes a big fan of sending them to Africa. So you have this guy who is anti-slavery, but is also pro-segregation. And that's the kind of that's the paradox that I try and explore in the book.
And you know, and I think we have on this program talked about this dynamic that there were abolitionists was one thing. But people who wanted to then welcome freed slaves into society was another thing. And so let's talk about the concept of colonial of black colonialism versus amalgamation.
Yeah, okay. I mean, so maybe an easy way to think about it is, so I'm from Britain, right? I spent 10 years in the US, but I'm conscious of sort of talking to you now on the radio as someone from the UK and sort of pointing the finger at the founding fathers and saying, you know, these guys screwed this up, they screwed that up. The really important thing to remember maybe, or a good way to start approaching this, if you think about Britain, so we here in Britain ran a massive slave empire, right? So we Brits were running slavery through colonial America, you know, when Britain was still partially in control of what became the United States. We had slavery throughout the Caribbean. But when people like William Wilberforce and Thomas Clarkson in the 1780s and the 1790s, these kind of heroes of anti-slavery in Britain, when they talked about abolishing slavery, they were going to be freeing people on the other side of the ocean in the Caribbean, in societies where black people were 90, sometimes 95% of the population. So their assumption was that they would end slavery, but there wouldn't be what you might want to call an integration problem, right? Because overwhelmingly, those societies are black. So the white slaveholders who've been doing all the terrible injustices, they'd end up leaving, or certainly they'd be in a tiny, tiny minority. Black people would, in effect, govern themselves. Take that over to the United States and go in 1800 or 1810 to Virginia or go to North Carolina, even into South Carolina and Georgia. You're talking about black populations of 30, 40, even 50%. So the really key thing to understand about American history is in this founding period, there are a whole bunch of white people that know that slavery is wrong. But unlike the Brits, who can try and end slavery in the Caribbean, you know, the Brits don't own the social consequences of emancipation. In America, if you're going to end slavery, you're going to need to do something about integration. And I think that we don't think enough about this challenge, which goes right the way back to the founding era. And it's a really key reason, I think, why you end up not seeing slavery abolished in some areas of the South before the cotton boom, which we all know about, that happens in the 1820s and afterwards.
And then we should say that then changes the formula, or I should say the equation dramatically, because then there is a people, I guess, conveniently forget some of those arguments about why one would want to abolish slavery because of the massive amount of free labor that all of a sudden just shows up.
Oh, yeah. Well, there are lots of problems with this, right? I mean, so in the book, what I try to do is go through two of the big problems that white people imagine, or two of the big issues that white people have. And so I'm thinking now about the founding fathers. I'm thinking about Jefferson and Madison and George Washington. But I'm also thinking about, you know, clergymen. I'm thinking about newspaper editors, if you want to call them a kind of liberal elite, you know, the equivalent of what we now think of as liberals very often. So I'm not talking about conservatives. I'm talking about the folks that we think of as being liberal. These guys looked at slavery, thought that slavery was wrong. But their first problem in thinking about emancipation was a whole bunch of African Americans who've been enslaved have not had education. They've not had access to the same kind of life choices and experiences as white people. So they begin to worry about what might happen if that population is freed right away. And they come up with a word for this. They call it degradation. They think that slavery has degraded black people. Now, we can get into whether that diagnosis is correct. I mean, you might argue that that itself is a kind of soft form of racism. But when it comes to concrete stuff like education or reparations, the first big problem is, who's going to do that stuff? Are slaveholders going to educate their slaves? Is the state government going to do it? Is the federal government going to do it? You know, this is more than 100 years before the New Deal, right?
Right.
There's no kind of big government around. So that's the first problem. The second problem is, if African Americans or Native Americans are going to be brought into society as equals, the next thing that's going to happen is intermarriage, right? Amalgamation. Now, why would that be a problem? Well, a whole bunch of white people, in theory, technically, they go to their Bibles or they go to their science books and they can't find reasons to be against intermarriage, to be against racial mixing. But actually, they still have these prejudices. And many of them are really fascinating, these white guys, because what they say is, I know the science says I should be okay with having a black son-in-law or a black president, but I still feel this thing. And they call it prejudice. Thomas Paine says it's like a spider that crawls into your mind and screws up your thinking. They're still dealing with this prejudice. And they can't, most of them, bring themselves to accept the idea that there's going to be racial mixing. So then they come up with a solution to this, which is basically to persuade Native Americans and African Americans to go someplace else. And that's where the book goes. It describes these movements. We talk about Indian removal, but also black colonization, these movements to persuade people of color to be happy with the idea they can be just like white Americans if they'll only go and settle somewhere else.
And so, I mean, there's multiple sort of like fronts to this, I guess, this argument, right? Because all the while, you still have a significant portion of the country, and then obviously it becomes even more embedded and entrenched when cotton comes, when cotton becomes king, I guess. But what were the arguments? I mean, what were the nature of the arguments of people who did not want to emancipate slaves at that point?
Well, in the early Republic, so if you look in the 1780s, take something like Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia, which he writes in 1782. Jefferson is a classic example of what I call in the book the anti-slavery slaveholder. You know, which seems like a paradox, right? I mean, it is a paradox. But these are people who hold slaves but persuade themselves that for all these reasons I just told you about, it's too risky to free slaves unless you can persuade them, when you free them, that they should go someplace else. And here's the big problem, right? So this idea as a slaveholder that you can support the abolition of slavery if you can colonize blacks in another part of the world, the key problem, the thing that makes this break down, is that African Americans themselves are like, hell no, we're not going. Why would we go to Liberia? Why would we go to Africa or the Caribbean? Why would we accept what these white folks are telling us that we need to leave? We were born here. Our ancestors were born here. We made the wealth in this society, and we're staying. So you see this kind of impasse in this early moment, and I'm talking now about the period before about 1825, where you've got some interest from slaveholders and even from very powerful politicians in the US in this idea of racial separation. But the secret source that they need is black consent. And they don't get it, reasonably enough, right? Because why would black people go? But here's the key thing, Sam. This idea that you can still persuade African Americans to realize it's in their best interest to leave the United States, emancipation and colonization, it carries on right through the 1850s. And you may already know this, but Abraham Lincoln, in the 1850s, one of the core planks of the Republican platform in the 1850s before the Civil War is that when slavery is ended, white people will be relieved from having to live next to black people because black people will be colonized somewhere else in Central America or the Caribbean or wherever else. So this carries on being a kind of pipe dream for white reformers right the way through to Abraham Lincoln.
And we should say, too, that Lincoln's initial proposal was simply to end the growth of slavery, as opposed to actually get rid of it wholesale.
Look, I mean, you know, people get very upset about this. I don't mean to, you know, trash Abraham Lincoln's reputation or, I mean, you know, in the 1850s and the 1860s, Abraham Lincoln, you know, he earned his reputation as a visionary political leader, and he was very closely involved in a series of events that led to the abolition of slavery. But to suggest that Abraham Lincoln kind of grew as a human being to the point where he accepted black people as equals is not only misleading, I think it stops us from seeing that this problem of accepting black people as truly equal, of agreeing to live alongside black people in freedom, goes all the way back to the beginning of American history. And here's something, I mean, something really important I want to say is that we often think about American history in the 19th century as a battle between the bad guys, who are the slaveholders, and the good guys, who are the anti-slavery folks. And all I'd like people to think about is that actually a whole bunch of people who opposed slavery were themselves slaveholders. They just couldn't find out a way to make integration work. And the majority of white people in the northern states who opposed slavery never thought they'd live alongside black people after abolition. So I think there was an integration moment in the early republic, and it got kind of screwed up. And I think we should remember that even as we continue to see slaveholding and slavery as a massive kind of toxic influence on American history.
Where was the biggest push for integration coming from?
Well, this is another big issue, right? I mean, I get into this a bit in the book. I mean, I haven't spoken much about Native Americans, but maybe this is a good place to put them. Okay, all right. Well, I mean, the same is true for both African Americans and Native Americans. What you tend to find is that the white reformers who are the most enthusiastic about the idea that black and white people might live alongside each other or might even intermarry, they're not proposing schemes for intermarriage, schemes for amalgamation and integration for themselves. They're proposing them for other white people and very often poor white people. Just to give you an example, the Secretary of War in 1816, William Crawford, you know, he comes up with the idea that you're going to settle white people on the frontier next to Indians and that they'll intermarry with each other. This creates a massive kind of, you know, newspaper controversy. And many of the newspapers in the eastern states say, listen, readers, don't worry about this because the white people who'll be doing the intermarrying are those hicks on the frontier. So that kind of class element you start to see coming into this as well. You've got your liberal folks who are proposing this stuff, who are planning these schemes for amalgamation, but they're actually not the ones who are going to do the amalgamating. Except, of course, when it's really going on, someone like Thomas Jefferson, who is sleeping with one of his slaves, refuses to go public on that. So I think that there is a kind of hypocrisy here, which makes some of these prescriptions for integration much harder to be successful.
And Jefferson, too, made a point of telling, at the very least, I think it was Mohican leaders that we're going to resolve this by basically, you know, mixed marriages.
Yeah, no, I mean, Jefferson tells all manner of native leaders during his first administration. So, you know, around the time that he's buying Louisiana, he tells all manner of native leaders, we shall all be Americans. That's the phrase that he uses. But there are a bunch of problems with that. I mean, one of them is, again, like it's sort of important for us to understand that when I say that all men are created equal is applied by the founding fathers to black people and to Native Americans, what's really going on in their minds is they're saying Native Americans and African Americans could be like us. So when we talk about equality, we're not talking about some kind of, you know, like cultural relativism. We, you know, the kind of stuff we do now, which is we try to understand each other's differences, you know, to value them and not to rank one society over one another. Well, actually, you go back to the founding period, and in a way, the equality that the founders see as being in the potential maybe for blacks and Indians is, you know, the equality of becoming a white person. And when it comes to Native Americans in particular, who've got very successful, you know, and very different societies, one of the problems here is that they don't want that kind of equality. And obviously that throws the reformers for a loop again, because unless you can get the people of color to agree to these schemes, they all fall apart. So there's a kind of cultural misunderstanding working here as well. And it's incredibly interesting, but really important to see that culture plays a role, like class, in screwing up some of these plans for integration.
Walk us through briefly, at least, how the evolution of the perspective of Native Americans from that notion of we will all be Americans to we got to resettle.
Well, the first thing I'd say is, I mean, if your listeners don't know the history very well, we are very often only kind of find out about Native Americans through college classes that, you know, all about white people taking their land and then Indian removal, you know, Andrew Jackson and the Cherokees and the Trail of Tears. All that stuff is really important. But when you learn about Indian removal in school, and especially Andrew Jackson, you imagine that this is this kind of racist, reactionary white guy who was expelling these Indians. What I found so interesting in researching the book is actually when Jackson does Indian removal, everyone has been calling it colonization. And the model they've had for it is all these plans to relocate black people. And it's exactly the same thing. So there's a whole process, political process and intellectual process of trying to figure out how Native Americans might live as citizens within the United States. And when that process comes to breaking point, when it seems very hard to get Native Americans to agree to become American citizens on the terms of, you know, white leaders, that's the moment where we move into this phase of saying they need to live someplace else. And I mean, a tragedy, well, there are many tragedies in American Native American history, but the tragedy here is that from the perspective of white leaders, so I'm talking now about people like Henry Knox and Timothy Pickering, who were the first secretaries of war, so the equivalent of the Secretary of Defense in the 1790s. So these are the guys in Washington's cabinet. What they thought was Native Americans didn't need lots of land. They could live on a smaller patch of land and that they would amalgamate with white settlers. Well, this is a totally cock-a-hoop crazy vision, which ignored the realities that Native people saw whites coming and were horrified. White people didn't play by the rules. The federal government couldn't really tell people what to do if they were in a distant state, because the federal government wasn't all that powerful. All kinds of disasters were taking place in the field while these very noble ideas for integration were being cooked up back in Philadelphia and then later in Washington. So in a way, the kind of escape hatch for all of these integration schemes that were failing was to propose that people of color should just go someplace else. And that policy was applied in the same way to Native people as it was to African Americans, with one big difference, which is that in the case of Native Americans, Andrew Jackson was actually prepared to pull the trigger and force them to leave. And this didn't happen with African Americans, which is one reason historians have missed the connections there.
And it didn't happen with African Americans, I guess, presumably because the African Americans that we're talking about at that point were perceived as property by a significant number of these white people.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And this is where you need to try and keep in mind the kind of the passage of time here. So what we know is in the distance, although what, of course, nobody knew at the time was coming, is that by the 1820s, you've got the beginning of this cotton complex. And so what I'm talking about there is the mass production of cotton, in effect, in the South by slaves. And again, some of your listeners may know that that cotton complex was made possible in large part not just by black labor, but by Indian land. And I'm thinking particularly about the land that the Cherokees and the other Southeastern Indians owned in places like Georgia and Alabama, and then heading over into Mississippi and Louisiana. So that cotton belt came about after 1820, precisely because the federal government was able to get Indians off that land. But here's the key thing, Sam. People in 1810 or 1815 aren't necessarily expecting that to happen. So at some point, slavery and all the economic motives around slavery provides you with a good reason to keep black people in chains and to push native people off the land. What I'm interested in is this nearly 50-year period before that economic logic becomes apparent. In many ways, the economic logic of slavery in a place like Virginia or North Carolina in the 1780s and 1790s is beginning to fade a bit. You can't make as much money from slavery as you could have done 20 or 30 years before. And this is the reason why slaveholders in that earlier period are willing to give this stuff, this emancipation stuff, some kind of hearing. The key question is why that first integration moment fails. And I think it's way too simple to say it's just the greed of the slaveholders, you know, that got rid of the Indians from their land and it forced black people to be permanently enslaved. It's these problems with integration that stopped a more widespread emancipation and incorporation of black people and Indians in that earlier period. And we've kind of forgotten that because slavery, it's like this black hole, right? It sucks everything towards it in our attempts to try and remember that period of American history. And it's really crucial, but it's definitely not the only answer to the race problems that we developed by the end of the 19th century.
So we have, I mean, just to, I guess, restate in some respects what you're saying is we have a period where the initial infrastructure to set up the country has been more or less completed insofar as, you know, where we had advanced technologically. And so there wasn't this, intense need for free labor. It just didn't have the labor was still free. It didn't have the same payoff that it would when we get to cotton. So the attachment wasn't as strong. Yet we as a society had not the governmental infrastructure that would be needed to actually complete this project in a way so that you would have new citizens who, you know, had the education and the skill sets and the understanding of being citizens that one would want in that era, I guess.
Yeah, I think you summarized that brilliantly. I mean, in a way, like, we don't like to talk as historians about what's inevitable, right? But if you think about slavery and if you think about this, like think about 1860 and think about 4 million slaves predominantly located in the lower South, growing vast, vast amounts of cotton, which is then going to be exported for huge profits. At some point, when the vision of that society becomes apparent to white slaveholders, it kind of blows everything else away. Like, that is going to be the way things are going to work out. I guess what I'm trying to argue is that, as you just said, that vision doesn't come into clarity. It doesn't sharpen its focus until the 1820s. So then in this earlier period from the 1770s, really, right the way through until the 1820s, you've got a whole bunch of white people, some slaveholders, some non-slaveholders, wondering how they can do something about the effects of slavery because they can't see it as being economically central to the nation's future. They sure as hell can't reconcile it with the Declaration of Independence, but they don't have those governmental structures to do something about it. There's no possibility for a kind of New Deal for people of color. Also, crucially, and this is something I really, really want to emphasize, crucially, white people ultimately fail the test of being able to live alongside people of color in equality. And as I said, part of that's cultural, part of that is class-based. But what I find so interesting about this is, you know, we live in a moment where we have huge amounts of segregation. We live in a moment where racial tensions are kind of everywhere. We also live in a moment at which nobody credible would get up and start arguing for racial hierarchies. Well, actually, in a strange kind of way, the early United States is not as different from our moment as we might imagine. And that's why I think it's so important to go back and study some of the screw-ups and some of the mistakes which liberal reformers make in this early period that make it harder for them to realize how you overcome the challenge of integration.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, you know, when we talk about trying to disaggregate the different forces here on both sides of this equation, right? Like the ability of the state to actually care for these people that are going to require services to be fully integrated, and then, you know, versus, I guess, sort of the economic factors that play into maintaining a subservient class,
right.
and all those issues. I mean, to a certain extent, it's just a question of these liberal reformers just not having the mental capacity, I guess, right? The imagination. I mean, people offering, let me put it this way, were there people offering suggestions on how to deal with this problem that they were ignoring?
I'm really pleased you brought that up. I mean, that's crucial, right? So one of the things I do in the book is try and introduce you to a whole bunch of experiments, a whole bunch of proposals for how you could deal with this. And I mean, we haven't got time now for me to go through them all. But for example, you'd have anti-slavery societies, which would set up schools in cities like Philadelphia and New York. So they would be, in a sense, charity schools, right? They weren't in the public school system as it was beginning to develop. And the idea would be that African Americans would be in those schools to get education. Those would be free blacks who had recently been freed, or perhaps free blacks who've been living in places like Philadelphia and New York for generations. You'd also get proposals from guys like Noah Webster, you know, the guy who put together the dictionary. Noah Webster in 1793 came up with a scheme where he tried to encourage Southern slaveholders to educate their slaves before they freed them. So in effect, to have this kind of laboratory stage, like a kind of probationary phase at the end of slavery for their slaves, where they could train them up and then they could free them and they'd have all the right values that they would need to survive. You'd have all kinds of plans for moving black people away from white people temporarily. The president of Princeton, a guy called Samuel Stanhope Smith, proposed in 1811 that you'd set up a black society somewhere in the West. You'd pay white people, white women actually, to go out and marry black men, and you create your ideal society in this little, you know, test tube. And then when that worked out, you could import the model back in. Some of these schemes seem so insane to us, but I do think it's important to realize it's not really about the mental capacity of these reformers. They came up with the ideas, they just didn't have the gumption, they didn't have the vision, and I think finally they didn't have the commitment to put them all together before the economics of slavery became irresistible, which is the story we all know from the 1820s onwards.
So just that Webster experiment, how did the slave owners react to that idea? I mean, because I imagine on some level, for those who are reluctant, you know, supposedly reluctant slave owners, I mean, well, I'm a little skeptical.
Here's what's funny. I mean, he actually said, Webster, that the model for this was not a racial one at all. You know what his model was? It was Poland, and it was serfs in Poland. So he writes in his treatise on slavery in 1793, Noah Webster, about the success of this Polish guy, a guy called Count Zamoyski, in turning his slaves, or his serfs rather, into free men. And he said, this worked out well for everyone. All we need to do is find some American Zamoyskis, as he calls them, who are willing to take up the experiment. I'll give you another really quick example. In 1798, one of Jefferson's close friends, a kind of protege of his, a guy called William Short, he's an American who worked for Jefferson when Jefferson was in Paris as ambassador back in the 1780s. Short wrote to Jefferson and said, hey, why don't we just marry our slaves? There's nothing wrong with the color of the people who are produced from white slave unions. This would be a fabulous way to try and get slavery out of the system. He sends this letter to Jefferson in 1798, and this is just before Jefferson goes back to Monticello. Jefferson's in Philadelphia right then. It's just before he goes back to Monticello to see his own mixed race son for the first time, Beverly Hemings. So actually Jefferson is doing the thing that his friend William Short is encouraging him to do. Jefferson just isn't coming out and telling people he's doing it. And Jefferson takes Short's letter and he puts it in a drawer. Then Short writes back to him a few months later and says, hey, did you get my letter about racial amalgamation? Jefferson puts it in the drawer. 25 years later, Short writes back to Jefferson and says, hey, you remember that plan I came up with for racial amalgamation? Yeah, that was kind of nuts, wasn't it? Why don't we just go with segregation? It's really important to understand just the incredible range of ideas that are out there that are circulating, not just in the North, but throughout states like Virginia and North Carolina and Maryland during this period. It's not like the ideas or the intentions or the kind of proposals are not there. It's that the society doesn't find a way to round behind them. I think that's partly because this idea of segregation, this idea of colonizing black people somewhere else, was so tempting to white reformers because it was a kind of quick and dirty fix, right? You could be separate but equal. And that logic of separate but equal, we usually see that as being something that follows the Civil War, and we blame racist white Southerners for it. Well, listen, I am absolutely down with blaming racist white Southerners for anything, and slavery one of them, right? They're partly responsible. But I am saying that the logic of separate but equal is not just a Southern white problem in American history. It's a white problem in American history.
Fascinating. Nicholas Guyette, the book is Bind Us Apart, How Enlightened Americans Invented Racial Segregation. Thanks so much for your time today. We will link to the book at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot, Sam. Take care.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. What's old is new again. I mean, yeah. I think the important thing from this is that when we see this type of, ugliness, racial racism in this country and or just sort of a more submerged white supremacy that it's woven into the fabric of our society. You know, there's so much about particularly with Trump that people are like, this is Trumpism. And it's not. It is simply we're just getting a slightly different perspective on and a quality of the American character that has been here since day one. And at different times, it becomes more clear than at other times, right? I mean, you don't notice that someone can't swim until they're in water. And it just so happens that right now we're in a period where we're starting to, you know, where we see this ugliness more. And really, we see it, and by we, in that respect, I say, like, you know, white society sees it more. I'm not sure that, and perhaps, you know, I think, certainly, I mean, I think if you're Muslim, you're seeing an increase in this type of hatred, and it, and I think it's different depending on what group you're a part of in terms of just how pronounced. You know, right now it's fashionable for the alt-right to embrace gay people because they use them as a way of bashing Muslim people, but I'm without really any data to bring to back this up. I suspect for the vast majority of African Americans, America's not looking dramatically different today than it did 3 years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago in terms of racial animus. It's just that it's a little bit more clear, I think, to white people because, you know, all of them are jumping up and down on TV now at Trump rallies. So, I don't know. Interesting book. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to have the fun half of the program, where we tell funny jokes and say funny things.
A Biki Bar Saka.
Biki Basaka, ladies and gentlemen. So bummed I missed that. Let's do this whole. Let me do this one story about, because look, it's pretty rare that I credit right wingers with anything. Okay,
these guys though, credit where credit's due.
You got to give credit where credit is due. I mean, where is the story I have on this guy? Where did I put that? Let's see. Okay, yeah. It's number 9 in my packet. All right. So, you know, folks know that I like to listen occasionally to right-wing radio. And my understanding is that I want to apologize for not being here on Halloween. But I got stuck with the kid. You know how it is. Halloween day. And Michael, of course,
nails are looking great.
Michael had to get his pedicure.
Mrs. Chow does a tremendous job.
I got to say, his skin looks radiant. Somebody also got a, took a schwitz and got a
facial.
But
it's fantastic.
So I don't know which order to do this in. Apparently, you all know the story of this guy, George Lindell, who was caught on tape at a Trump rally yelling, "USA, USA, USA," holding up three fingers, which some people say is a symbol for KKK. I don't know.
Matt?
But let's... And I said something like that. We're run by the Jews in there. So that's George Lindell. Now, a lot of people would be like, wow, that guy seems to have a problem with Jews. He seems to be, I mean, I don't know. I suppose you could argue he's celebrating the Jews, but I think it's really more he's against the Jews. But to be fair, credit where credit is due, these guys from, what is the name of the show? The Ken, Ken, and Ken show?
Yeah. I'm a little confused. There's three guys on it, but
whatever.
It's tripled one name.
Okay, and Michael Schur was on the program. He's from TYT.
It's a little awkward for us, actually.
He's on the show, and I got to say, these right-wingers, they did a pretty good job with this. Check it out. Just ask this question of you, Michael, since you're a Jew. How come nobody's even contemplating the possibility that this guy was just making a Mexican joke about the way they pronounce their Y's, right? So it's like, Jew go over here, Jew want to get lunch, Jew want to take a nap now. But nobody's, everybody's like, Jew SA. Like, he's promoting the fact that maybe we should, maybe, I happen to disagree having open borders, but maybe saying, like, Jew SA, like, we should have allowed Jew people to come in here.
Yeah, let's go with your take on it. Let's say that that's what he was doing. It's still ugly talk to be knocking a Mexican person.
Why? He's not knocking a Mexican person. He's welcoming them to Jew SA. It's like your SA.
Welcome to Jew a new home. What's the problem? I don't understand. That, you guys, it's like you...
Now, to my ears, that sounds pretty crazy. But, to be fair... Robert Mackey in The Intercept reports that George Lindell claimed that his pronunciation of the letter U in the name of his country just sounds like Jew because, as a house painter, I'm around Mexican people all the time who mispronounce it that way. That's the way I say USA, he insisted. And apparently he went on to say that he was standing around some Latinos at the rally and was just trying to make them feel comfortable.
He was wasted.
So there you have it. Chalk one up for those guys. And you can go, what's the just site there, YouTube page? What is it? Ken and Ken Show? On YouTube? Yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this with the fun app, 646-257-3920. Don't forget, your membership makes this show possible. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Your membership makes this show possible. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And when you buy that coffee... we get a little kickback. I don't know if people understand that dynamic.
Just read the Clinton emails. I think you'll understand all of it.
Yeah, I will go over the Clinton scandal that was texted me or I tweeted me, and I will go over it, and it'll be interesting. And don't forget, majorityreportkickback.com. If you buy crap from Amazon or jet.com, buy it through our link there. We get a kickback, majorityreportkickback.com. Back in a second.